Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So today we're taking a really close look at a creative force, someone whose career, well, it's just a powerful example of how sticking to specific personal stories can lead to, you know, huge recognition.
Absolutely. We're talking about Sterling Harjo.
Exactly. Yeah. Filmmaker, showrunner. We're basically charting his whole journey today.
Yeah, and Harjo is, I mean, he's undeniably a pivotal figure right now, not just in the film world, but really in the whole story of indigenous media representation.
Right.
Our sources, they really show this clear, sustained focus on place, on his community. And that just defines, well, pretty much every single project he's touched.
It's like the ultimate example, isn't it? Starting with indie films, doing that foundational work, and then having it lead to this absolutely groundbreaking success in television.
Totally. And that's really what we want to dig into today.
Yeah, that's the mission. We want to give you a kind of shortcut to understanding how he built this incredible career, you know, from those early independent shorts and features, using Sundance as a launch pad, all the way to becoming a MacArthur Fellow, which is just huge, and co-creating Reservation Dogs.
It's about the strategic steps, right?
Yes.
The moves that made him such an essential voice in American culture today.
Definitely. So to really get the work, you have to understand the roots, as you said. Where does it all start?
Okay, so the basics. Sterling Harjo was born November 14th, 1979, Holdenville, Oklahoma. And this is critical. He's a citizen of the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma and also has Muscogee heritage.
And that's not just like a biographical footnote?
Not at all. It's the absolute core, the wellspring of his creativity. You look at his work, almost everything from the very first films to the current stuff on FX, it's set in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
It features Native American characters, Oklahoman people, often tackling themes really specific to, you know, the Seminole and Muscogee experience.
So his identity isn't just woven into the work. It is the work, in a way. It's the foundation.
Precisely.
So how did that commitment, that really hyper-local focus, translate into a national, even international career?
Well, the groundwork was laid academically, artistically. He studied art and film at the University of Oklahoma.
Okay.
And what you see, looking at the sources, mm-hmm. is a young filmmaker who, right away, he sought out support from the kind of key players in American independent film.
The institutions.
Exactly, the institutions. We're basically tracking how that early focus, that authenticity and sense of place, it attracted institutional backing that really paved the way for the massive industry recognition he got later on.
Okay, so let's unpack those early years then, because the recognition, it seems like it came remarkably fast. When did the industry really start paying attention?
Almost immediately after his time at OU, actually.
Mm.
His vision, which was, you know, focusing on contemporary Native life, something incredibly underserved in movies. Back then, it just caught the eye of the major gatekeepers.
Right.
So in 2004, he gets this really prestigious fellowship from the Sundance Institute.
Which is a huge deal for an indie filmmaker.
Yeah. Oh, massive. I mean, a Sundance Fellowship is often the biggest stamp of approval you can get early on. It means funding, yes, but also mentorship, connections, access. It's critical.
And it wasn't just a one-off thing, was it? Getting multiple fellowships suggests they really believed in his potential?
Absolutely right. Just 2 years later, 2006, he gets another big boost. This time, a fellowship from United States Artists.
Okay, United States Artists. Tell us a bit about them.
Well, they're known for identifying and backing some of the country's most compelling artists, you know, across all sorts of disciplines, writing, visual art, film.
So it signals he wasn't just seen as a promising filmmaker, but like a broader cultural talent.
Exactly. Getting both the Sundance and the USA fellowships, I mean, that really solidified his status as someone to watch, even before he'd finished his first feature film. It showed the indie world was already betting on his unique voice.
And that confidence, it was built on his short film work initially. You mentioned Goodnight, Irene.
Yeah, that was 2005. Goodnight, Irene really put him on the map. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2005.
Kicking off that Sundance relationship.
Precisely. That became a really powerful, consistent relationship for him. Sundance was the platform, and Goodnight, Irene, it didn't just play there. It won a special jury award at the Aspen Shorts Fest.
Ah, okay.
Which shows his storytelling was connecting beyond just the Native film community. Mm-hmm. Critics, audiences were responding.
So that pattern, launching at Sundance, it leads us right into his first feature, Four Sheets to the Wind, in 2007. How did this film kind of lay out the Harjo blueprint?
Four Sheets to the Wind is like the definitive statement of what he was about early on.
Mm.
The story itself, it centers on this young Seminole man. He travels from his really small, specific hometown. The sources really emphasize the small town aspect.
Right.
To Tulsa, He's going to visit his sister right after their father suddenly passes away.
Okay, so things of grief, family.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Grief, dislocation, family bonds, but all framed by that physical Oklahoma landscape. And it's contemporary.
And the critical reception for this debut, it was pretty significant, wasn't it? Nominated for the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance 2007.
Yeah, which is massive for a first feature, competing at that top level of indie cinema right out of the gate.
Incredible.
And beyond Sundance, he was named Best Director at the 2007 American Indian Film Festival, AIFI.
AIFI, okay. That recognition seems important, too.
It's crucial. AIFAF is dedicated to celebrating authentic Native representation. So winning there confirms his standing within the indigenous creative community, while the Sundance nomination confirms his place in the broader industry. He was hitting both.
And what's really interesting, you pointed this out, is how his work immediately started boosting the careers of his actors, too.
Yeah, that's a really key point for you listening. The film's co-star, Tamar Podemski, she won a special jury prize for her performance at Sundance.
Wow.
And then followed that up with a nomination for Best Supporting Actress at the Independent Spirit Awards in 2007.
So it wasn't just about his vision, it was about creating opportunities.
Exactly. It shows his authentic storytelling, his ability to direct actors. It immediately translated into mainstream recognition and, you know, real professional opportunities for his indigenous collaborators. He was building something bigger than just his own career right from the very start.
So the foundation is really solid by this point. Sundance backing, major fellowships, awards, launching acting careers, and all of it anchored in Oklahoma. He was setting a standard.
Mm-hmm. And if Four Sheets to the Wind kind of introduced that road trip theme, his second feature, Barking Water, in 2009, well, it really deepened that whole idea.
Okay, so still on the road, but how did he change it up? How did he raise the stakes?
Barking Water shifts the focus. It's a much more intense journey. It's a final journey, really. It follows a dying man and his former lover on a road trip across Oklahoma.
Another Oklahoma road trip.
Yeah, but with a very specific destination and purpose. They need to get to Wewoka to see his daughter and granddaughter.
So it's not about finding yourself after grief, like the first film maybe hinted at. This is about time running out.
Exactly. Mortality. And again, the location, Wewoka, it's not just some random town.
What's the significance?
The sources explicitly note it's the capital of the Seminole Nation.
Ah, okay.
So that grounding in specific, culturally significant places is always there. The physical journey across the state, it becomes loaded with cultural meaning. It's a return to the heart of the Seminole Nation before death.
And the reception. Did Sundance embrace this one too?
Yep. Premiered at Sundance 2009, keeping that streak going. And it was named Best Drama Film at the 2009 American Indian Film Festival. So again, consistent success on both those important tracks. It shows a really smart strategic balance he maintained.
Okay, so after two narrative features focused on these road trips, he does something quite different in 2014. A documentary, This May Be the Last Time. That sounds intensely personal.
Oh, it is. Deeply personal.
Yeah.
It's rooted right in his own family history. The film's based on the true story, still unresolved, of his grandfather who disappeared back in 1962. Happened in the Seminole County town of Sasakwa. You know, a family mystery like that, it's a powerful hook for any documentary.
For sure. But the real insight here, for you listening, might be how he used that personal story to explore something much broader, right? Specifically music. How did that work?
Yeah, this is where you really see his skill for, like, cultural synthesis. The doc uses his grandfather's disappearance as a jumping-off point to explore Creek Nation hymns. Mevscoke hymns.
Okay, hymns. That's fascinating.
And what's really amazing is the detail it goes into about the musical lineage. The film specifically looks at how these traditional Creek hymns, they have these melodic connections to, get this, Scottish folk music.
Scottish folk music, really?
Yeah, and blended with influences from American gospel and even rock music. It shows that the Creek musical tradition isn't some isolated thing. It's actually this dynamic, evolving mix of global influences, all filtered through their unique cultural lens.
That detail about the Scottish folk link, that's brilliant. It shows he's not just, you know, documenting tradition, he's analyzing its complex history.
Exactly. And that thoughtful approach got noticed. After premiering at Sundance in 2014, AMC Sundance Channel Global picked up the distribution rights for the Sundance Channel. So we got significant global exposure.
Okay, so after that deep dive into family history and music, he swings back to narrative features in 2015 with Mekko. But this one's different again, right? The sources call it a thriller.
Yeah, a thriller, which is a really interesting shift in tone and genre for him at that point.
Why do you think he made that move after these intimate dramas and the Doc?
Well, I think it's both artistically and strategically smart. By framing Meko as a thriller, he kind of sidesteps expectations, you know, the indigenous drama label.
Right.
The film's set in Tulsa, Oklahoma, so he's still committed to his location. But it specifically focuses on the experiences of a Native American homeless community there.
And using the thriller genre in that context, that must have a specific purpose. It's not just for thrills.
Oh, definitely not. Genre films, especially thrillers, they demand high stakes, a certain pace. They force you, the viewer, to engage intensely.
Right.
So by setting a thriller within this often marginalized community, Harjo uses the genre's intensity to shine a really bright, urgent light on the harsh realities of Native homelessness in a city. He's leveraging the commercial hook of the genre to deliver some powerful social commentary.
Makes sense. Where did Meko launch?
It premiered at the Los Angeles Film Festival in June 2015. So yeah, by this point, he's shown real versatility across indie dramas, documentary, and now genre filmmaking.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're moving into the period, let's say, roughly between 2015 and 2020. And this stage is actually really crucial. This is where Harjo was kind of honing all these diverse skills, comedy, journalism, directing shorts that would feed directly into the huge television success of Reservation Dogs.
Right. People sometimes skip over this period, but the work he did here seems vital. He was juggling like high-profile festival stuff with really local media work.
Exactly. So on one hand, you have him directing short films like Sapan Futu's Tessin in 2009. That was part of something called the Embargo Collective Project.
The Embargo Collective.
Yeah, it was a collaborative effort specifically aimed at boosting the presence and quality of indigenous filmmaking. Harjo, being part of that, shows his commitment to, you know, working with others to nurture Native talent and stories.
And staying connected to Tulsa, to Oklahoma, that remained important.
Absolutely vital. Hmm. Kept him grounded creatively. He was the staff video director for this land press in Tulsa for a time.
Okay.
Directed a whole series of shorts for them. That's practical, boots on the ground production experience in journalism, local storytelling, fast turnaround stuff.
And at the same time, he's getting recognized internationally.
Yeah, like serving on the shorts competition jury for Sundance in 2010.
Yeah.
So he's got a foot in both worlds.
Yeah.
The local media trenches and the peak of the international festival circuits. It's quite a balance.
This period also really highlights his comedy chops, which might surprise people who only know the earlier, heavier dramas. He's part of a pretty influential comedy group.
Yes. We absolutely have to talk about the 1491s.
Okay, tell us about them.
Harjo is one of the five founding members. They're a Native American sketch comedy group. And their work, it's just brilliant, sharp, observational, often really subversive humor that tackles Native stereotypes, contemporary life, everything. It's smart and hilarious.
In that collaborative comedy environment, how formative was that? How did the style of the 1491s influence what we eventually saw in Reservation Dogs?
Oh, the connection is totally direct. The signature tone of Reservation Dogs,
yeah.
You know, that deadpan, realistic, often kind of surreal humor about everyday life.
Yeah.
Mixing these profound moments of grief or identity with genuinely funny, specific conversational dialogue. That blend of high emotion and high comedy, that's the DNA of the 1491s.
Oh, okay.
Working in that group allowed him to really sharpen his comedic timing, find those conversational rhythms that make the Res Dogs characters feel so real and, well, lovable. It taught him how to use humor not just for laughs, but as a way to critique culture and create genuine connection.
And even while flexing his comedy muscles, he kept up the commitment to community news and journalism. That's a rare combination.
It really shows profound dedication. He served as one of the directors for the Cherokee Nation's monthly TV news magazine, Osio, Voices of the Cherokee People.
Wow.
Think about that range for a second. Respected indie feature director, touring sketch comedian, and directing for a tribal nation's news program. That experience, capturing real life, delivering information clearly, grounding stories in specific community concerns, it made him uniquely equipped for episodic TV. He could blend the realism of journalism with the humor of the 1491s. And all of that, that whole diverse foundation, it leads directly into the television era, which kicks off, of course, with the show that changed everything, Reservation Dogs.
Yeah, Reservation Dogs. Ran 2021 to 2023 on FX. This was a huge leap, right? Co-created, co-written, executive produced by Harjo, but also with Taika Waititi involved. How important was that collaboration?
Oh, it was genius. Pairing Harjo's deep, specific, localized knowledge and sensibility with Waititi's, you know, global profile and proven comedic touch.
Right, Waititi had massive momentum then.
Exactly. It gave the project instant viability, commercial appeal, while making sure the creative core stayed completely authentic, rooted in Harjo's vision. And for FX, a network known for betting on distinctive voices, it was a major win. They gave them an incredible amount of creative freedom.
And the recognition was immediate and huge. That moment at the Film Independent Spirit Awards really stands out.
Yes.
Yeah.
The 37th Spirit Awards. It won Best New Scripted Series and Best Ensemble Cast in a New Scripted Series. Big wins.
But the real impact went beyond the awards themselves, didn't it?
Absolutely. It marked a historical moment that, frankly, needed to be celebrated loud and clear.
Can you recount that moment for us? Because the quote itself really sums up the achievement.
Yeah, actor Devery Jacobs, accepting the Ensemble Award, she gave this incredibly powerful statement. She said something like, "This prize is so much bigger than ourselves. Each of us come from different nations across Turtle Island who survived 500 years of colonization."
Wow.
And in the 100 years of film and TV, Reservation Dogs now marks the first project with all Indigenous creatives at the helm.
The first project with all Indigenous creatives at the helm. I mean, just pause on that. That is genuinely transformative for the industry.
It really is. It proved that authenticity, that full creative control by Indigenous people, it's not a risk or a niche concern. It's actually the key ingredient for making critically acclaimed, universally loved television.
And the industry responded. Peabody Award in 2021.
Yep, got the Peabody. FX renewed it for season 2 almost instantly. It confirmed the show was a hit critically and commercially. It completely validated that Harjoy TD model of Indigenous-led storytelling.
So the success of Res Dogs obviously catapulted Harjoy into this position of being a highly sought-after showrunner, someone with the power to get new projects made. Which brings us to his second FX series, The Lowdown.
Right. After Reservation Dogs wrapped up its run, Harjoy launched The Lowdown, premiered in September 2025. And here, he took on even more creative control, creator, writer, director, executive producer.
So this was Harjo showing he could lead a major network series solo post-Waititi collaboration?
Pretty much. Proving he wasn't reliant on that initial partnership to get a big show off the ground.
And the casting for The Lowdown really speaks volumes about his status now, right?
It absolutely does. The series stars Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke. Okay, that's major.
Yeah. Attracting an actor of Hawke's caliber and reputation to a brand new FX series, right on the heels of Res Dogs, it just signals that Harjo is now seen as a top-tier creator. An auteur, really. Somewhat capable of delivering prestige, high-quality TV. His name now carries weight, guarantees artistic integrity and visibility.
Yeah.
It allows him to keep telling these unique Oklahoma stories, but on the biggest possible stage.
But even with these massive TV shows, he's still keeping connected to his roots in indie film and music.
He is, yeah. In 2023, he directed a music video for the Turnpike Troubadours. They're an Oklahoma country rock band.
Ah, back to the Oklahoma music scene.
Exactly. It circles right back to that deep connection we saw in his documentary, This May Be the Last Time. And on the film front, in 2024, he co-wrote the screenplay for Res Ball.
Okay, Res Ball.
Yeah, sports drama directed by Sydney Freeland. Him co-writing that shows he's actively collaborating with and supporting other Indigenous creators, lending his expertise to projects that continue exploring Native life, specific Indigenous stories. He's still building that ecosystem.
It's just an incredible trajectory, isn't it? From those early Sundance films all the way to leading multiple major FX series. The recognition he's received, it feels like a fitting summary of a career built on insight and a deep sense of place.
Yeah, the recognition is layered. It starts, importantly, within his home community.
Yeah.
Back in 2011, he got the Tildman Award from the Oklahoma Film Critics Circle.
Okay, local critics recognizing his focus early on.
Right, showing they understood and valued his dedication to telling Oklahoma stories. A couple of years later, 2013, the Tulsa Library Trust gave him their American Indian Writers Award.
Those early local honors feel really significant.
They are. They show that the communities he was portraying, they were the first ones to really validate his work before the national and international awards started rolling in.
And those bigger awards, they are truly staggering, especially for someone who broke through with such a specific, uncompromising focus.
Absolutely. We mentioned the Peabody for Reservation Dogs in 2021, but the real pinnacle, the definitive acknowledgement of his entire creative contribution came in 2024.
The MacArthur Fellowship.
The so-called Genius Grant.
That's the one. Harjo was named a MacArthur Fellow in 2024. And here's the detail you really need to remember. The sources are explicit that he was the only filmmaker chosen for that honor in that specific year.
The only filmmaker. Wow.
Yeah. The fellowship recognizes, quote, "exceptional creativity and a pronounced capacity for self-direction," It's about a lifetime of contribution. That selection just underlines the profound, lasting impact of his work and his absolutely singular vision in redefining what American storytelling can look like, centered squarely in Oklahoma.
It's such a powerful arc. From being an OU art student determined to capture seminal and Muscogee life in indie films, to becoming this national creative leader holding one of the most prestigious arts awards in the entire country, Harjo's career just demonstrates so clearly that authentic, localized specificity that's maybe the strongest tool a storyteller has.
Yeah.
He took the specific roads, the family stuff, the music, the humor of Oklahoma,
yeah,
and showed the world these stories are universal, compelling, and frankly, urgently needed. He didn't water down his vision for Hollywood. He made Hollywood recognize his vision.
That really sums it up perfectly, that deep commitment. So we've seen how he used those cultural roots to create a genuine historical landmark with Reservation Dogs, the first truly indigenous-led show.
Right.
And then immediately followed it with another high-profile series, The Lowdown, pulling in major star power.
His career is like a roadmap, really, showing how deeply specific, geographically rooted storytelling can actually achieve global impact.
Okay, so that leads us perfectly into our final thought for you, the listener, to mull over. Harjo has proven he can turn pretty much any corner of Oklahoma culture into groundbreaking TV. Mm. We know he's committed to the place, and now he clearly commands significant resources. Just look at casting Ethan Hawke. So thinking about that, what unique, maybe untold aspects of his cultural world? Could it be different musical traditions, maybe specific urban indigenous experiences beyond what Mecco touched on, or perhaps a really deep dive into the modern day politics or history of the Seminole Nation? What might become the setting for his next groundbreaking series? What stories are still out there in Oklahoma waiting for Sterling Harjo's unique lens?